So a few questions, perhaps? Maybe you could take the lights up, please.
I apologize, this is not a question in response to your wonderful talk. This is going to be very brief. I'm speaking into the mic.
Right. Do you think you could get the lights out of my eyes, because I can't see anybody?
Better? As we all know, there are thousands of people in Washington in the streets amassed today to protest the war. And on Monday, representatives of the activist groups are going to be lobbying in Congress and presenting petitions to end the war. And I'm here as a representative of Artists Against the War, circulating a petition, and it'll be outside the door. If we could have hundreds of feminist activists, we will get the petition to members of Congress. It's a one-sentence thing demanding the end of war torture and illegal detentions.
Thank you. We'll all look for it outside.
Thank you for a terrific presentation, Aviva Rahmani. One of the issues that you obliquely touched on was fear. And at least one in four women, one in seven men have experienced rape. That includes this audience. And I wonder how much we as feminists have been willing to own our own fears, our own monsters, in order to connect us with all the other monsters.
I can't speak for the collectivity of feminists in this instance, although I think that you, you clearly raise a real and serious point. When I was citing the writing of Sarah Hamill and her horror that rape occurred in, a dormitory at Berkeley, I was certain that everyone in the audience was saying, but we know this, this happens all the time. And those of us who teach, routinely every semester, have a woman in our class, mostly a woman, whose life goes off the rails because she has been raped. I mean, this is one reason that I, in this lecture, place so much emphasis on the question of men and the problem of men. I think that this is something that that feminism does have to challenge directly, but has never yet, to my knowledge, found the way to strongly address. I mean, I would, or to effectively end. The analysis of rape, of course, goes to the question of violence, I feel unqualified. I'm sure there are people in this audience who have read much more and are much more knowledgeable on this topic than I am, and I don't want to stand here and give inadequate readings of what is a serious problem. But I certainly think I agree completely that this remains is a serious problem, and I think that all those who are in a position to work on it should actively do so.
I was struck by during your talk about the way that you're redefining feminism, and mm-hmm. I was appreciative of the sense of a refusal to totalize, categorize, leave an allowance mm-hmm. for flux. And I was curious, I was thinking that if we embrace your definition, then some of the artworks that we were talking about would shift. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be talking about the same things. And I'm interested in wondering hearing you talk a little bit about the sort of self-consciousness of the project of feminism and how variable that might be. Meaning, do you think that the artists that make the work of the feminist imagination are necessarily taking that as their project, and if that is a goal, that you think is a primary goal now for artists, or, and I guess the sort of self-consciousness of the labeling and the way that that term comes up.
Let me see if I think I really have your question in my mind. I think I make a distinction between the intentions of the maker of the work of art and the goals and scope of the interpreter of the work of art. And so therefore, I mean, you're right to read my paper as wanting to admit into feminism kinds of work that may not have been produced with feminist intentions. And this, I think this is what the act of interpretation allows, and that as feminists, we can, you know, interpret the world and reach and take hold of what it is that we feel that we need. And I mean, in this, I think I differ strongly with some of my revered colleagues in the audience in their attitude towards modernism. I don't reject modernist tendencies, you know, or modernist strategies out of hand, far from it, because I think the negational is essential as a feminist tool, for one thing. And I think that there's a complex relationship between the evolution of any visual language, which should understand its relationship to modernist practice. And lastly, I've never thought that artistic intention, excuse me, artists, is all that important to how I receive the work in the final analysis. but in saying all this, I'm slightly concerned that I haven't come to the heart of your question.
No, I was sort of asking to rethink about the, I guess, the work of feminist criticism, which is what I think your paper did so nicely, as opposed to artwork that somehow figures women in certain ways. Not that that's not part of that, but the answer did get to what I was thinking.
Well, I think I think rethinking the work of feminist criticism actually gives us much more complex access to, you know, to a deep history of culture, which, Lord knows, in our barbaric times, we actually need. You know, it's and that we have to assess the complex ways that visual languages go about their work of structuring and the world and communicating to us. So, thanks for your question.
Hi, my name is Shrimoi. Thank you so much for your presentation, and I'd really like to thank Deborah, Alex, and Jessica Fain for bringing me here, and all the running around with the visa. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about the statistics on India and China, and it came up yesterday as well with the statistics of women going to university in Iran. I find it a little problematic when we talk about different cultures just with statistics, because what tends to happen is that we infer what women in those different societies might be like based on these statistics. Not that the statistics are inaccurate, not that female infanticide is not happening, it is. But what's also happening are a lot of really strong, powerful women and long traditions of powerful women which never get written about, which never get heard. And so, you know, we're victimizing a culture. So getting to my question is how, and I find as well among feminists, this tendency to victimize women, which I have a huge problem with, of victimizing sex workers or victimizing, not that once again, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, definitely there are victims, but I think that there's a problem in propagating the victimization, if I'm making myself clear at all. And I wonder how do you deal with that, the problem or the paradox of victimization?
Well, one of the things I asked for in my paper was to avoid the cold center and to speak from passion, which you've just done. But I will say that I drew no inferences of the kind that you suggest in my paper. And the we of your speech, we draw inferences, is a particular we that I'm going to opt out of. The problem that you speak of course, is a problem, and what we want to have, and there I want to be part of that we, and I want to find you in it, is a conversation back and forth. I suppose I would want to ask you what you would want me to have done differently.
Well, I don't see the reason, perhaps, to state for the statistics, because what it does is that it's something that we hear all the time, and we don't. What we don't hear is the positive things that are going on and the way women are making a difference in different parts of the world. I guess what I'm saying is the framework is very different. And so when we're talking about different regions and different places, the framework is different. And we have to look at it and think about it and try to understand. Because there are different frameworks and we all come from different places. Mm-hmm. So in order to be able to talk about different societies, we need to first try and understand the different framework that we're talking about. Not that that justifies, the female infanticide and, the genital mutilation or, any of those terrible practices. But I'm just saying that when we talk about different places, we need to avoid those stereotypes, because that's what they become then. If that answers your question.
No, not quite. I mean, in terms of how I would do it differently. But, I will definitely, I obviously hear you, and I am... I would want to, learn how to change so that it was not possible to be read in the ways that you are reading this paper. I mean, yesterday we heard from Gita, and she certainly gave us one view of art by women in the context of India. We heard about microcredit. We have different viewpoints. At the same time, the coincidence in the birth rates among the difference in male-female birth rates in China and India is a striking fact, which I don't want to ignore. But thank you for your question, Griselda.
Thank you very much. I want to pick up something that I thought was really remarkable in your paper that I wanted just to make sure was given back. But just in comment of that, if only we read more. I mean, Chandra Tulpati Mohanty has already written the great book about the question of under-Westernized, about how Western women writing about third world women do this. Gayatri Spivak already did this critique about how we're all studying the subjectivity of Jane Eyre, but there's just the black woman, the other woman. So I think I would recommend the book Under Western Eyes as a book that shows how we have to decenter ourselves and view the world. And just a recent experience I had with a professor from Nigeria, Malara Ogundipe, talking about African feminisms, where she asked all of us to say our views of Africa before we discussed it, so we all exposed ourselves to all the usual stereotypes. And she turned around and said, okay, well, from Africa, we look at Europe and we think, oh my God, they've got so much cancer. Look what they do to children. You can't just have your children on the street because they're going to be violated and raped. So turn it around and imagine how it looks from another place, and that might help. But anyway, your talk was really so exciting because you've brought back the question of art and imagination. And by talking about the political imagination or the imaginary, allows us, and also by bringing in Mary Kelly as one of your references, this crucial question we're trying to put together, which is something to do with feminism as a perspective that has deep roots in social, political, economic critique of injustice, but at the same time it has a specific operation that is at the level of the aesthetic. And it reminded me of Gavin Janchis, who was a South African artist, writing just after 1994 and saying the problem is all the guys who are now running South Africa from the ANU have come back, ANC, I'm sorry, have come back from the Soviet places where they were trained and thinking the only thing you could do is to make art about the violence, to make art about the violation. And he argued, this is Gavin Janchis, that unless artists could imagine a future beyond apartheid, and any artist who dared to do anything that wasn't just, you know, socially oriented was seen to be somehow betraying the cause, artists would not be able to contribute to the political change that people dreamt of. They would be always the servants of the system that repeated. Now, it seems to me we're in this same debate just now, that they're valorizing only a certain kind of feminist work that seems to be closely related to this kind of indictment. Now, we do have to do it, and you do have to have as many statistics as the Guerrilla Girls or what you were saying to show how bad the situation is, how much we still need feminism. But I'm really grateful to you for bringing back the sense that there's a point to being an artist or an art historian in this struggle. It's not that we have to go onto the streets just to be feminist. It's the point of learning to read artworks as means of critique and imagining something. So I really welcomed that part of your paper, and I was glad that it is going to shape the discussions today.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Elizabeth White. While I embrace the term feminist for both myself and my work, I share the concerns raised yesterday about perhaps how that term is often used as a historical term to refer to work in the past, and also what you brought up as one of your students was saying today about how it's used in popular culture with perhaps a lot of misunderstanding. So I'd be curious to hear you talk about what you feel, whether the importance of holding on to the term versus, you know, perhaps the limitations of that, both as artists and as people who write about art.
Well, I find it hard to imagine a lexicon without the term feminist, and maybe it's my age group. But I think what I would be wanting to aim at would be a situation in which people would those I teach, undergraduates, for example, to relentlessly place it in the context of teaching where I am, where the term feminist could be kept alive and identifications would be possible for young people today with the term, which it isn't. Nobody, you know, you ask some group of undergraduates and they, a minority will make that identification. I think that it's hard to imagine sort of doing without it just because its history is too honorable and too important to my sense of the politics. But, you know, ultimately, that will, if there were some sort of new wave of political activity with feminist goals which changed the terminology, would I ultimately regret that? Not finally, of course not. I mean, the ends are much more important than the name. Am I taking the heart of your question there or not?
I think so. I mean, I think I'm also interested, just as an artist, in what space is available in the art world for a specifically feminist conversation, I feel like it's sort of the kiss of death for an artist to say that their work is feminist at this point, because it seems like it's easily relegated to the past and it's no longer contemporary. So obviously a lot of people in this room feel differently, but I'm not sure what the realities of that are.
I think that ultimately though, I mean, your art maybe wants to wiggle free of most labels. So, I mean, if it's genuinely kind of doing some sort of original work, it might be difficult to label or where, you know, bury its agenda or make its agenda so skillfully instilled that it can do its work painlessly or without labels or something like that. Is it this side? I think so.
I'll lean into the mic. I should apologize, not a question here, but a comment, and one, the content of which Griselda Pollack has already sketched out fairly well. But just to add that it became clear to me again hearing your talk, and it's something I've thought about over the years, I guess, in relation to feminism, that it's a movement or a program that has as its agenda precisely complexity and contradiction and nuance. These are goals of interpretation that are embraced in many ways, but it's a funny thing and a very useful thing to have it put forward as a platform. Contradictory in itself, since having a platform, right, would tend to work against those other goals. And yet you've done it. And then the question always remains, and I don't think it's possible to dispel, but maybe just to think about even more intently for the rest of today, how you combine that with other very real goals in the world of, you know, combating things that seem a lot less complex. And I mean, especially in a time when in our own country, complexity is practically a curse word. So, I'm just struck by this, by your talk, by Carrie's talk yesterday, bringing these up, you know, ways in which that could be achieved. So there you go, there's the comment.
Thank you.
My name is Barbara Zilker. I would like to know what your take is on the fact that while the conference is an extraordinary step in the right direction for the feminist discourse, why there are still so few women of color in this room. That's a really cynical response. And I think just from having heard a few young women of color who have spoken, we can see what a different approach that brings to the entire conference. And these were issues that, as a feminist, I and my colleagues were dealing with over 30 years ago. And when I look around the room today, and as I did yesterday, I still see mostly Caucasian faces.
Why do I think that there are so few women of color here today?
Involved in this feminist discourse here today, speaking to us, feeling that it's a vital thing to be part of?
I think that I would have to reach back to my Marxist education and say that at the current time, as my students have pointed out, that access to feminism is deep, and moreover access to art is in the whole deeply tinged by class, and class and race go deeply together in the context, in the US context. It's certainly the case that people of color are in the strong minority at Berkeley, that everything in our culture is operating to make this so, that, you know, the proportion of, for example, African Americans who have access to higher education in the state is diminishing all the time. So if we are here at the apex of, at this sort of institutional pinnacle, what we find reflected in the room, actually this room is more diverse than classrooms at Berkeley at the current time, which is sad enough to say. So to answer your question, I think that what happens in this room is absolutely consistent with and what happens in many aspects of the culture, but I also think that feminism and the educational system, the ideological state apparatuses. But I also think that feminism is institutionally not bridged the gulf between its own engagements and those of people of color. That would be the answer I would give you.
I think we have time for just these last two questions.
That just brought up so much more. But you asked when Srimoy was talking, one of the things you asked was, you know, what can you do? And I think that asking that is the most important thing, is for people to be able to say, what can I listen to, and be open mm-hmm. and listening. I mean, I think mm-hmm. that's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I did have to respond to that also, because especially in regards to what I was hearing about Iranian women last night, there was an Iranian women's movement started in the 1800s, and it's something that happened up to the revolution and has continued. It's been broken apart, and you know, for many different reasons, it's not something that's recognized here. Mm-hmm. And what we see is only the opposite of that, and you know, what's been portrayed in the media, and of course, showing that. Only that view of victimization is what helps, you know, make war happen, makes it give more reason, I mean, to sort of justify going to war. So, I mean, I guess I'm thinking about the stereotypes and what that perpetuates. Yeah. I'm not saying you would say the opposite of that.
Yeah, no, but I mean, what you say, of course, and what the other speaker said is profound and necessary. And I mean, obviously, the complex ways in which Islamic attitudes towards women as they're misrepresented in this country feed into the energies of war is an enormous topic that we, you know, which is deeply serious. And I'm really, you know, happy for you to like mention the Iranian women's movement in the context of this room, because that is such a central fact. So anyway, maybe you want to ask your question.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm just like, going back. I was also thinking about the word feminism and how it is, it's interesting that you did talk with the different students and to get a sense of what is going on and what people are thinking. And as far as the word feminism, it seems like no matter what new word would come up with, I mean, would probably be demonized as well, because it's the ideas that are with that that are I'm sorry if I'm not being articulate.
No, you're fine.
Are criticized, and yeah. It's really good to see that this is happening here. How do you think that is, considering it is MoMA, and considering that this conference is going on here, makes me think that perhaps it's not going to be, or it wouldn't be so complicated to call yourself an artist that's a feminist that's doing feminist work? And also in response to that other question, and what do you think about that? Is that something that's perhaps changing through these different events and things and talks and symposia that are happening this year?
I don't know whether it's changing. I think that's the jury is still out on that. I think it's going to be an extremely interesting spring, and that everyone will be wanting to sort of absorb how this event, how the exhibitions that are coming up are going to be glossed in the media. This will be absolutely one moment to perform ideological critique, because however it happens, it's going to be necessary to interpret it. I don't think it will be all good. Anyway,
thanks.
So,
Hi
there.
Thanks. I wanted to bring attention to another group I saw missing in the room today, and that is large presence of males. And sometimes as an MA art history student, I feel like feminist discourse doesn't, a lot of my male colleagues don't associate with it. And for me, I find that very disappointing, especially in regards to issues like rape and areas where I think that male involvement is crucial. And when we talked about some of the areas or nooks and crannies that feminist theory isn't getting into in the present moment, I thought maybe that was one of them. I wanted to ask if you think that the parameters potentially need to be opened up in the discourse to try and reach this area.
Well, I agree with you completely that it's a great sadness that all men are not feminist. It's more than a sadness. All men should be educated as feminists. And but I'm again kind of going to fail to give you some sort of formula about how that should occur, even though I am certain that it ought to occur. So I'm one of these people who gets really worried about time. So I'm just kind of wondering, can this go on forever? Okay.
Hi. I just want to ask about this issue about anti-essentialism and how you advocate, you know, like being against polarization and binary black and white thinking, and how you advocate a multidimensionality to your notion of political resistance. I was wondering if you think that there's any case to be made for when the oppression is so totalistic that you need to be essentialist in your resistance, that political resistance has a clear-cut bad guy and a clear-cut good guy. And, you know, I think anger is essentialist in certain ways. And that I was wondering if you think right and wrong has gradations.
Say the last thing again. What
if right and wrong has gradations, that it's gradational? Because that it seems to me that...
I'm going to duck whether or not I think right and wrong has gradations. But I'm going to say that, I mean, obviously, historically speaking, there have been times when the essentialist position has seemed the appropriate one, and it's been occupied strongly. My own eschewing of that position, I have to say, is deeply autobiographical. I personally have never felt that it was easy to be a woman, that I inhabited the category comfortably, that I knew how to do it. I've always personally felt like I was... just didn't have that down. And I think that, I think that much of my own work, I mean, for me, the category is such a socially constructed category, and there are so many ways in which my own self-description cannot be matched, no matter how hard I try, to either the notion woman or women, that any essentialist position has been out of bounds from as long as I could think.
Hi. My comments are certainly prompted by something that you have been talking about, but I'm not actually going to ask you to answer for anything that I'm going to say. Actually, rather, this is a comment about this sort of conception of this as a conference about feminist futures and the choices that were made. One of the things that struck me is, yes, absolutely, there is an issue that, especially in the art history classroom, especially in the realm of contemporary, of people wanting to sit down and think about and talk about the importance of contemporary art, there is a sort of demographic issue that, you know, that this is, in the American Academy, primarily something that is being addressed by white men and women, primarily women. But beyond that demographic reality, beyond the kind of sort of recognition of that, choices have been made in terms of how a conference on feminist futures at the Museum of Modern Art was going to be conceived. And those choices were very particular, and I think they need to be kind of recognized as such. There are artists like Lorna Simpson, Kara Walker, who could have been here to discuss some of these issues. There are historians dealing not simply with a sort of immediate present or immediate past, but a history of modernism, and I do appreciate yours and Carrie Lambert's attempt to kind of reintroduce that issue, and obviously Beatrice Colomina's issue of trying to reintroduce the issue of the writing of history as itself a form of political intervention, and certainly this is speaking to the comment that Griselda Pollock made, but I find it fascinating that the first attempt by the Museum of Modern Art to really bring this into this institution, bring this discourse into this institution, itself has created a certain set of partialities that I think obviously you can't, I mean, obviously none of the speakers here can be made to answer for and shouldn't be made to answer for, but certainly raises the issue of as an institution, how is MoMA framing feminism as a contemporary discourse, as a discourse in the present, and then as a discourse in the future?
Right. Arunya, I think that you've put all of that much more eloquently and vigorously than I could have, but I agree very strongly with everything that you've said. Thank you very much.
I should have answered that one. Thank you. That was great.
I think I should comment on the last comment. And actually, Kara Walker, among many others, were people who were invited but weren't able to attend for one reason or another. And I think when I mentioned at the beginning that we plan a series of conversations in the future, that's because we had more than double the potential speakers that we wanted to invite here and couldn't for one reason or another. But I should say that we did have special ideas in mind. We have 7 curatorial departments representing, I think, as you know, photography, video, painting, sculpture, media. And we are all representing, the curators are representing those departments, and we wanted to try to bring people who might speak to those concerns of those departments. We also wanted to have an intergenerational point of view. So I think we've been successful at that. And we wanted to have an international point of view. So we've brought people from Europe, from India, and we had a speaker who's African. We also have an artist who's from Kenya. The speaker from Africa, unfortunately, said he couldn't come about 48 hours ago, so that he would have been on the last panel. So I think we tried to reach the goals that we set out for ourselves as best as possible, and we hope to continue the conversation in the future. So thank you.